This one does not have that. This one has a very big three solar panels attached to it. So usually when you go to the inner solar system or Earth, or, you know, they think nothing of running solar panels. When they go out there, no solar panels. Well, the technology has improved so much with the efficiency of them, although they still need very big. I mean, these things are like, 30 feet by 6 feet. Each one is that big, Dick. So quite huge. But, that's what will power this thing when we drop it. And they say physically it's the biggest spacecraft we've put up there. Unmanned spacecraft, anyway. That doesn't count for the International Space Station. So I thought I wanted to mention that. Those are upcoming missions. Like the one I like is the Juno. There's a couple of other missions. Another solar mission similar to ACE or the European Space Station. ESA. They have their own solar spacecraft that's been operating for years. But this one is called SDO, Solar Dynamic Observatory. You know, that we're going to launch, and that'll go up next year. But that's another huge thing. I saw a picture of it in the where they're building it. And, you know, based on the size of it, man, this thing looks like it's about 40 feet high. And who knows how big a diameter, it's probably 15 feet diameter like most spacecraft. But it's going to be launched by the Atlas V, which is, that's our heavy lift vehicle. If they're using that instead of a Delta II, you know, it's a very big spacecraft. The Atlas V has replaced the Titan IV, which used to be our heavy lift spacecraft, rocket for any kind of spacecraft. Atlas V, and then you've got the manned spacecraft, of course, STS-130, and they're going to put up another module that's going to interconnect everything, called Tranquility, and that's it should have gone up this month, but it's going to be going up in February. What I like about that one is it's got these big windows attached to the Tranquility, and this setup is going to be like a control tower. We've talked about it before, that you'd be able to stand up in this thing and look out these windows. Each half a dozen trapezoidal meters, each one looks like a trapezoid, but rounded on the edge. You can't have anything pointy for pressure problems, but basically trapezoid looking windows, and you'll be able to look out, get this almost 360-degree view as spacecraft approach and depart, be able to look at Earth, and that would be a very, very cool thing to be in. But my big thing is the Juno spacecraft. Of course, the Mars rovers, and you've got another Mars rover. Let me drop it. In 2011, you've got another rover that will be launched to Mars. I think they call it the Mars Science Laboratory. So that should be pretty good. That'll ride around, hopefully, on Mars for another 5 or 6 years, like Spirit and Opportunity. And that's pretty much it. Dick, back to you. This is WS2N.
Fantastic, Paul. Quite an update. Now, I was a little bit busy doing something else when you gave some of the earlier details, therefore I may be asking you for a repeat, but still, give me your best guess. How long will we be using the space shuttle? How long will we be using the International Space Station? The space shuttle was supposed to go obsolete real soon, but if they did do that before the replacement craft comes along, there's going to be a long period of time in which there is no backup. Will be thoroughly dependent on the Soyuz launches. So what's your best guess as to whether or not they've extended the period of time that we're going to be using the space shuttle
Well, originally they said 2010 would be the last flight. But what happened was they had a certain amount of flights that had to be completed for the space station. So they agreed on when these flights are done, and that was around, oh, I guess, when they had about 10 flights left. And you now have 5 flights, space shuttle flights left, that's it. You've got this Ford, February flight, and then a couple of other flights during the year, and most of them are going to be to restock the space station. This is the last of the, you might call it, the assembly modules that are going to be put up. They call them nodes. Unity is a node, six-sided thing that attaches everything. So they're quite big. It's like a room in itself. And these are interconnecting pieces. Let me drop it. The first one was called Unity. By the way, they have the kids name these things. Unity, and then you have Harmony, and now you got something called Tranquility. They have contests. And all the nodes get named. So that means that my guess is 2011 will be your last space shuttle flight. They're not going to cancel. A lot of them are restocking flights and things like that. But yes, we will be dependent on the Russian flights, and maybe even Japan's thinking about getting putting people into space. China already has, but they're not part of the International Space Station. You know, they might make a deal with them and have them dock there. That would be something. And European Space Agency, they were supposed to launch people from South America years ago, but that never came off. But they would still like to do that many years from now. But you're right. Until we go up again with our Constellation program, we'll be dependent upon the Russians and going up and coming back. So not a good situation. Space station should last another 10 years. Let me drop it. That's the last I heard, a 10-year usage, and it will probably be extended like most space missions, as long as they're going good. The Mir, it was Mir was supposed to be, 5 years, and that went like 15 years, I think. I can't see putting all this hardware up there and just getting another 10 years out of it and cutting it short and deorbit everything. Wow. That would be a shame and a waste, I think. So there you go, Dick. I think that's the two questions. Wanted to bring up the acronyms some of these space missions have. Juno, by the way, the one I was talking about that's going to go to Jupiter, is not an acronym. They got that from Greek mythology. Back to that. WS.
Very fine, Paul. Thank you. I sense most of that is reasonably good news that it's going to be extended somewhat. And I'll bet you that just like whether or not we go back to the Hubble Space Telescope and do another repair. I mean, the previous administrator of NASA made a hard decision that we're going to give up on Hubble. All the Hubble huggers came out of the woodworks and said, no, that we really like that spacecraft. Please fix it. And they did. And I think the shuttle is going to be extended because I'm not hearing enough words that lead me to believe that the replacement for the shuttle is going to be online soon enough. So thank you for all that information. I hope Irwin is still there, W2TRP. I found my card file. I haven't looked at it for 10 years. And you're lucky I found it, Irwin. So Irwin, are you online? Because I got some information for you. Some of it's good news. W2TRP, K2RIW.
K2RIW, W2TRP.
Okay. The two guys I knew about that were heavy into ATV was W2ORM, Whiskey 2 Oboe Radio Mike, Frank Larkin in Islip. Don't worry about him. He appears to be a silent key, or at least he doesn't have those call letters anymore. But the real spark plug, the guy who held it all together, was Mike Chirillo, Whiskey 2 Oboe Tango Alpha. Mike Chirillo, W2OTA, in Wantagh, New York, on Bruce Street, Bruce Drive. I just looked him up on QRZ.com, and Mike, W2OTA, has renewed his license on October 22 of 2009. He's born 1925. That makes him 84 years old. He's a very spry guy, a real tough character. And so, not surprised at all that he's around, still alive and kicking. He was the major spark plug on fast cam television on Long Island, in my opinion. And since he's replaced his license 1.5 months ago, I think he's alive and kicking, and he'd love to hear from you. I have an old, old telephone number for him, good 12 years ago. If you want, I'll give it to you, but maybe it's an unlisted number, so you can always come back to me, call me on the phone on that one, Irwin. But it looks to me like he's the main guy you want to look for. Whiskey 2, Oboe Tango Alpha. W2TRP, QRZ, QSL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QSL, yes. But that's great. Yeah, I'll look him up. I'll tell you, I'm not that much younger than him. I'm 81. And, but I race walk 4 miles a day and do 100 push-ups. So I try and keep myself in shape. And but I want to get back to ham radio. Like I say, you know, this shock with my wife put me into a depression. I find that I have to get my interest back. So I'm definitely taking my equipment, my ATV equipment. It's been in the basement and all that. And I have a room full of antique ham equipment upstairs. And I'm starting to get some of this equipment together to get back into it. And I'm still answering questions a lot of people ask me on the energy, and I'm back in touch with Ed Lowe, who did my Newsday articles. K2RIW, W2TRP.
Very fine, Irwin. And keep up the good work. When you do talk to Mike, let's hope he's got a listed phone number, Mike Chirillo, C-H-I-R-I-L-L-O, and you can look him up on QRZ.com. You'll see a lot of information about him there. C-H-I-R-I-L-L-O, yes. Let's hope he's got a listed phone number. His wife is also a ham. His wife is Whiskey Alpha 2 Delta Tango Zulu. Whiskey Alpha 2 Delta Tango Zulu. His wife's name is Rose, and I think quite often she was the subject of some of his fast scan television transmissions. So, please come back next week and let us know whether or not you had any trouble getting a hold of Mike. But since he just renewed his license 1.5 months ago, I think he's alive and kicking and waiting for your call, if you know what I mean, Irwin. Guarantee you guys are kindred spirits. Good luck with that project. Please let us know how it goes. I'd like to hear about that one. And now, I think we've freed up all of our previous questions, and I think we're about to discuss balance. Let me double check that I haven't forgot anybody. And if so, we're going to discuss balance with real seriousness. K2RIW listening. I heard WA2ARQ, I heard KE2EJ, and I also heard Wesley. I heard KE2EJ first. I think we've been waiting long enough this time and not timing out the machine, I hope. Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Oh, you've been doing real fine, Dick. And I did get a chance to ask the engineer to design our tubes. And what he says is, you know, when you get to the actual filament voltage that it's rated at, as you go under it, very slightly under it, you get a slight increase in cathode current. Because what actually happens is you're boiling the electrons off because you're not making it hot enough, so to speak. But it's a very, very small area. Now, when I've adjusted the tubes, it's always been in, you know, tenths of a volt. So I've never really gone way down and made the filament cold. But he says as you go just to the point under the rated voltage, you'll get a slight increase in cathode voltage, and then it drops like a rock after that point.
And is that point where you lower the filament voltage and get a slight increase in emission for reasons that are a little bit mysterious to me, is operating in that area destructive to the cathode? Does it shorten the tube life in any way? Is there a definite disadvantage of doing that? I'm guessing the answer might be yes, due to the fact that the manufacturers strongly recommend that you run the filament for some significant number of minutes before you apply the high voltage to the tube. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, what he says is that it's very destructive. What you're actually doing is you're causing the chemistry, whether it's thoriated calcium or there's a number of different chemicals that they use. You're actually wind up boiling it off the surface so it doesn't come back, so you shorten the tube's life pretty radically. But there is a point where the cathode current remains constant and you get the best emission. That may be slightly under or slightly over the rated voltage. You have to kind of find that. And as with most high-power tubes, you want to let it cook and get up to temperature before you think about putting any screen voltage and high voltage there on the plate.
Now, here comes a tough question, Eric, and it may require some more research. If I'm in that dangerous region where I'm a little bit low on filament voltage and I'm boiling off valuable chemistry from the cathode, try to explain to me why when I go to the rated filament voltage, I go to a hotter filament, that chemistry no longer boils off. I'm a little bit amazed that a higher cathode temperature does not cause the valuable chemistry to boil off. What in the world's going on there? Over to you, Eric.
You know, Dick, that's a really good question, and I don't have the answer to that on the tip of my tongue. I remember a few years back when I was learning about these ridiculous tubes that I use, they made mention of it. There's actually a little zone in which the chemical bonds behave well on the cathode surface because it depends upon the metal that they use for the cathode. Typically, it's a high-temperature metal. It's not aluminum. It's something like a molybdenum alloy, something that withstands that kind of heat and yet still maintains the bond between the actual cathode chemistry because it's deposited on that hunk of metal. All I can say is, I give him a call tomorrow and ask him the question.
I'd appreciate that, Eric. We're slowly getting smarter. And when it comes to these tubes, they got some real magic in what they can do. But you got to treat them with tender, loving care. You got to treat them right. Or they're going to just like your teeth. Be true to your teeth or they're going to be false to you. Be true to your tubes or they're going to give you troubles. Okay, looking forward to what you find out. The next person who signed in was, I think it was Victor. WA2 Alpha Romeo Quebec, if I heard the call letters correct. Your audio was a little bit low. Let's find out how well we can hear you, Victor. WA2 ARQ, K2RIW. Antenna G5R, you know the one I mean. I can't think of what Lou Varney's call letters right now. G5RV. Okay, I heard those two words. I can tell you're asking a question on those subjects. Bear in mind that when you move your handy-talkie around the room so you get the strongest signal from the repeater, that is not the best position where the repeater hears you, because you're transmitting on one frequency and listening on the other. And there's lots of wavelengths between you and that repeater, and it all gangs up. So you've got to move to another position. Maybe we're going to hear your audio. Give it one more try, yeah. Vinny, I think it is. W-A-2-A-R-Q, K-2-R-I-W.
K-2-R-I-W, W-A-2-A-R-Q. How is this, Dick?
Tremendous improvement. I presume you're on a base station rig or you're on a real antenna. And boy, do I wish you had done that the first time. Over to you, Vinny.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Handle here is Vic, Victor Ida Charlie. Yeah, I'm back on my 746 Pro. I also have a D700, but we got the Pro going into a five-element beam up on the roof. My question to you was, I have a north-south oriented full-size Wyndham for the low bands, and which has got to be changed. Cabling, they say change every 3 years. The thing's up there about 7 years, and it's still working very well, even with the band conditions. I'm either going to go up there and put another Wyndham up there in its place, a brand new one with recabling, because I'm getting an Ameritron amp in another month or two. That Wyndham will not take the power, and I want to put another one on a east-west orientation. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, whether I should go with Wyndhams or G5RVs. K2RW in the TechNet, WA2ARQ.
Very fine. Glad you got back to a real rig. Handy talkie from Huntington all the way to the repeater is, unless you're living on top of a mountain, doesn't work well. I'm on 300 feet above sea level land, and my handy talkie running 5 watts gives an extremely marginal signal into this repeater. So it doesn't surprise me that you ran into the problem you did. Someone maybe have told you that your cable has to be replaced every 3 years. Not necessarily true. As long as you've got a reasonable quality cable with reasonable waterproofing, there's nothing stopping you from using a transmission line for 10 or 20 years. The particular transmission line you're using, you're hearing me through right now, is 20 years old. Let me think. 1975? Huh. It's going on 30 some odd years old, the cable you're listening to me on right now. It happens to be a piece of hard line. The only kind of cable that I know of that's got a short life, let me drop, is the foam-filled cables that are flexible. They slowly absorb moisture, water, vapor slowly migrates through the outer polyvinyl jacket and gets into the foam and drastically increases the loss at VHF frequencies. It might not necessarily be increasing the loss so much at HF frequencies. That's something to be measured. So, and the newer kinds of foam cable, the ones that have got a foil layer underneath the outer vinyl jacket, which gives you weatherproofing so that the water vapor can't get through, they have much longer life. So before you throw away that old cable, run a couple of simple tests. Measure the insertion loss. Now, I'll admit that putting power at the bottom and putting your watt meter at the top is a bit inconvenient. You could temporarily create a perfect short circuit at the top and simply at a low power level at the bottom in the shack, measure standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio is how much power goes up and how much power reflects back because of an impedance mismatch at the antenna connection. A short circuit is a perfect mismatch, and so if your cable had, for instance, 1 decibel of loss when it was brand new, and if it's still in good shape, it might have still close to 1 dB of loss. a perfect short circuit at the far end of the cable would be 1 dB of loss going up, reflection off the short circuit, no loss. Another dB coming back down, you'd have 2 dB of round trip loss. With a simple calculation, which I could give you, I could tell you a 2 dB reflection coefficient, what standing wave ratio is that? And maybe the answer is a 15:1. Or if you're using a bird watt meter, you can measure exactly how many watts going forward, how many watts is coming back, and from that you can calculate decibels of difference between the two and know what is the two-way loss of the cable. So measuring the cable loss is my strongest recommendation before you throw it away. You may be throwing away a perfectly good piece of cable. That's item number one. Let me drop. Item number two, if you have built your Wyndham antenna or your G5RV out of reasonable materials to run 1,000 watts of peak envelope power sideband into that antenna is not a problem, unless you made the antenna out of 30-gauge wire. And even 30-gauge wire, with the duty factor you've got with single sideband, might survive. So the fact that you think your antenna can't take 1,000 watts of peak envelope power sideband, I'm skeptical of that. What do you think it's going to do, Vic? Victor, you think it's going to catch on fire and explode? I doubt it. The whole value of the antenna is so inexpensive that if you've got to replace it because you've damaged it with high power, it's not the end of the world. I mean, if it burned up the wire of the Wyndham itself, it's burning up $3 worth of raw materials, if you know what I mean. So I'm skeptical your antenna is that power limited. I'm skeptical that your cable is that bad. I think you're in a lot better shape than you think you are, and therefore some of the changes you think you've got to make, you might not have to make. Just because the right number of years has gone by doesn't count. It's like people used to say, gee, my car is 2 years old, everything's about to fail, I better replace it. Or some people would make a joke and say, the ashtrays are filled, it's time to replace it. Well, I buy 5-year-old cars and drive them for another 10 years. That's me. Because if you've got the ability to fix things, an awful lot of things that everyone believes wears out don't necessarily wear out if they're properly treated. That's a bunch of opinions. Vic, back to you, W82, Alpha Papa Quebec, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2RIW, Whiskey Alpha 2 Alpha, Romeo Quebec back. Thank you very much, Dick. The reason for changing the cable is not that the cable is bad. The reason is the power. The Wyndham is a pre-made Wyndham, bought store bought from I don't know R&L Electronics or whatever. I'm changing the cabling to put the power into it, and of course 1,000 watts into RG58U. Well, guess what? It's not going to take it. So that's the only reason why I was going to change it. I have cabling up to this antenna, the 2 meter, which is 9913. It's working very well. That's 7 years old as well, and I'm not concerned about the age. I'm concerned about the power level, and I know that that's the factor. I have to change the balance of the power level as well. But my question actually was, which would you prefer? A G5RV or a Wyndham, as far as you and your background with antennas are, does one outweigh the other? Or I know that there's a vertical component with the G5RV that I'm not overly concerned about, but just in general, which would you prefer, Wyndham or G5RV?
My first guess, now I understand, and I missed when you told me RG58, and yes, that is pushing it with a kilowatt. A kilowatt on 80 meters on RG58, sideband, it will take it. 10 meters, it's going to get hot to the touch. And even if it's got some extra insertion loss, it's not going to burn up. I would try it, but yes, to replace it is the Cadillac approach. But now when it comes to comparing a Wyndham to a G5RV, it's close to like saying, will I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette? In both cases, the antenna question and the marrying question, there's a lot more variables involved. Now, there's a guy on frequency who has used both of those antennas has a fair amount of experience, because he's an HF man as well as a VHF man. I'm not an HF man, and I'm pretty light on knowledge on HF. So I'm going to ask Mel, when it comes to comparing a G5RV and a Wyndham, what are the pros and cons of each one of them, Mel? I bet you and your merry group of guys at the Kings County Radio Club have used both of those antennas. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yes, this is K2KEY. Used about both of them. Found that a G5RV worked pretty good as far as going from like 80 meters, 40 meters, even down to 20 after that. Didn't see really really good performance above 14 megahertz on the G5RV, to tell you the truth. As far as Wyndhams go, you know, Wyndham is fairly a straightforward antenna, simple to construct, and haven't used them extensively, but have had experience with Wyndhams, and I would say somewhat positive. If you have the room, I don't know what frequencies you want to cover, but if you say you want to cover 80 through 10 meters, and you have the room, I would say a Wyndham would be maybe a little bit better performing antenna, but of course, that's just my opinion, Dick, over.
Of all the people who have signed into the TechNet, a number of guys, not all of them, but a number of them have said that the Lou Varney antenna, the G5RV, gave them some grief at 10 meters. A reasonably high standing wave ratio is what they usually complain about on 10 meters. And you're saying that even 10 meters and 15 meters, you weren't thoroughly happy with a G5RV above 20 megacycles, above 20 meters, above 14 megacycles. You said its performance was a little bit marginal. Another thing worth considering, Vincent, is that these antennas are not very expensive. I don't think you should consider either or. I think you should do both. Maybe you're going to set up one north-south and one east-west. But wire antennas and the feed line going to them is not expensive. Fill up your backyard with wire in various directions and various lengths and whatever, and run side-by-side experiments with them, is my recommendation. So, let me turn it back to you, Vin. WE2, Alpha Romeo, Quebec, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW and the TechNet, this is Vic. Victor Ida Charlie, WA2ARQ, over here in downtown Huntington Station. Okay, very good, Dick. This is exactly what I thought the answer would be, the general consensus. I've been very happy with the Wyndham, and I haven't had any luck on 10 meters because of the band conditions, but when 20 meters is open, I get the G5RV has got a vertical component, and with the lateral line, and so does the does my Wyndham with 33-foot tails. And having it 40 feet up, roughly 35, 40 feet up, there's a little bit of NVIS there. But I'm pretty well satisfied, and as I said, I can do either or. I also have we're running the Icon 746 Pro, and I do have an MFJ Versatuna, 989C, so we're all set up for if I got to run a lateral line into the tuna, so... and that's a 3kW. The only thing is I'm going to have to change, as I said, the Ballon. I'll get the full-size Wyndhams. I think I'm going to use both. I think I'm going to just go with the Wyndhams with the 2-kilowatt Ballon, which I think is your next topic of conversation. Let me drop to the repeater. And I'm going to have to change the duplexer up on the 6-2 and a 70 centimeter beam I have up on the chimney, because that's got it looks a little funky, but I may be running a little bit more power And I want to put a little bit more professional ballon up there than the one that's up there that they gave me, which is, I won't mention the company, but it looks like it was put together with bubble gum and a prayer. Okay, I'm going to bow out, guys. Thanks very much for your input. I really appreciate it. This TechNet is always there when you need an answer. Kudos to you, Dick, and the rest of the crowd. K2RIW and the TechNet, WA2ARQ will be off clear in QRT. Thanks a bunch, guys, and have a great night. And I'll be just reading the mail for the balance. Bye-bye.
Comment.
Okay, Wesley recognized. Sounds like we got a satisfied customer there, Mel. We got to send him a bill. That's a joke, Vic. Don't worry. Vic, also, don't worry if you've got some vertical component out of the antenna. A vertical component of radiation on a so-called horizontal antenna is not bad. It could be good. On top of that, whether you set up a horizontal or vertical antenna is a function of your local real estate, what resources you've got, how much altitude you can get, how much ground plane you're willing to put up. All of those are variables. And don't worry about cross-polarization, because the majority of what you do on HF is ionospheric reflected transmissions. Very rarely are you talking to a guy on ground wave. And we all completely forget, we all completely forget about the fact that when you take a plasma medium, that's what the ionosphere is, it is a plasma, mixed with a magnetic field, and the Earth supplies the magnetic field, you will have Faraday rotation. You may launch a perfectly horizontal signal from your QTH in Huntington Station on Crest Hill Court, and that signal is going to hit the ionosphere, twist, I'm going to pick a number, 3 or 4 times before it gets over to your buddy in London. And when it gets there in London, your horizontal signal, after all of that Faraday rotation, could very well arrive vertically polarized in London. And Faraday rotation does not obey the law of reciprocity. The guy in London may be using a vertical antenna, and you would think logically that he launches vertical and you're going to get horizontal. No. When it goes back in the other direction, he may launch vertical and you may get vertical after a couple of twists. You launch horizontal and after a couple of twists, he gets vertical. On top of that, we've all heard QSB fading on the HF frequencies. Sometimes it's because the signal overskips or underskips the target. Sometimes it's because the rotation is changing and you're using a horizontal antenna and the signal is arriving vertical at your QTH and you see a fade. So polarization is a lot more complicated than you think, and the fact that you may have some vertical out of your antenna isn't necessarily bad. It could be good. Also, making sure you've got a high enough power to the ballon is good. If you didn't, if you set up any of the antennas that we amateurs, any of the antennas we amateurs normally set up without a ballon, you will, in almost all cases, have some extra current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. That can be either good or bad. The bad part is if you got RF in the shack from that mode, that's not good. But the fact that your feed line is also doing some vertical radiation, we'll say, might not be bad. And so if you had some kind of a switching arrangement where you could make it happen and stop happening, it would be an interesting thing to experiment with. So you'd be amazed how many guys are afraid to transmit to somebody who they know is using a vertical antenna because their antenna is horizontal, and they assume ahead of time the guy's not going to hear them. Ain't anywhere near that simple. Let us know how that works out and come back and tell us about it, Vic. Now, we had Wesley wants to make a comment on this one, and Wesley has another question. We're going to come back to you on the question if it has any significant amount of time to it after we discuss balance, Wesley. But if you've got a brief comment, go right ahead. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I got a quickie for Mal, W2EWK.
EWK, you're on the list. Stand by. Go ahead, Wesley.
When you mentioned the vertical properties within the antenna horizontal, You didn't mention one factor. You mentioned only the bouncing and the reflection from the ionosphere, stratosphere, from the spheres of the air. But you didn't say anything about, let's say, G5RB mounted as inverted V with the mass, let's say, 1825 feet in the middle. And then the arms will be 45 degrees from that. Back to you, Antoine.
Okay, Wesley, give us a few words on that. If I did use a G5RV, not the way Lou Varney original article had it, which is kind of a flat-out horizontal antenna fed with twin lead and fed with coax cable, if I used it as an inverted V, where I've got a higher support in the center and the tips dip down, you then have a broadside pure horizontal polarization from the antenna. End view, you have vertical polarization from the antenna. And so in different directions, you have different polarizations. And I think you're saying that's an advantage, and that maybe that's something that's desirable. I think that's what you're saying, Wesley. Back to you, Wesley, K2LIW.
That is definitely the advantage of it. When you have something that is horizontal and then you bouncing it from the spheres, I call it spheres, the layers, from the layers, then the chances are of changing the polarization much smaller. I remember there was Mohakov, there was the Russian ham radio amateur in the Stalin time. He was doing the research on the antennas. He was actually army engineer. Actually, not Bukhachov, right? I don't know how to write it. He proved, and then he put this concept of the antenna into most of the military dipoles, which actually in Poland, these dipoles were used as an interverter V. Instead of the two masts, they were installing one mast and two additional smaller ones to keep the 45 degrees. The range was drastically improved. Most of the smaller military bases, they had vertical antennas, and many of them in faraway region, they had horizontal one. The signal difference was close to none. Back to you, Antoine.
QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. Sounds like there's a significant advantage based on the experience of your Russian engineers who experimented with the inverted V, and where it's transmitting a nearly pure horizontal end signal when you look at the inverted V broadside. When you look at it end view, it is nearly purely vertically polarized. In between, you're getting some of each, therefore it's launching elliptical polarization. So you have more kinds of polarizations in more azimuthal directions hitting out that ionosphere when you use an inverted V. It does sound like a significant advantage. Now, when it comes to people making a comment on all of this, we've got Eugene and Glenn in that order. Eugene, W2EWK, go right ahead with your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is W2EWK. This is for Mel, Mel only, on 10 meters. on 10 meters, what time is the net, what frequency on 10 meters? QSL?
You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KY, Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, 28.380. Every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, G. Over.
Okay, thank you very much. 11 o'clock, Sunday, 28.380. Okay, thank you, Mel. W2EWK, back to net control.
Very fine. Glenn, KC2QIQ, you've got it.
Yeah, good evening, morning, Dick. Just a couple of mentions about the G5RVs. I've played with them quite a bit and experimented with them a lot because I love their size and the general characteristics of them and the broadband performance that you can get in multi-bands. You can cover most of all of the HF bands. The first couple of times I've experimented with them and hanging them up, I wasn't all that lucky with them. I was having a lot of difficulty. And what I found out through enough experimentation is that the closer you get it to a T-shape, and it would completely, where the wire lines are completely almost a straight line, and you pull that elevated feed line all the way up in the center and try to support it somehow on something non-metallic, you can basically cover 10 through 80 meters very, very well. When you get away from that T-shape and you start taking on other shapes, you start losing bands, like 10 meters will fade away real quick. The other things too is if you mount the G5RV, well, when I did it, I was finding that the closer I got to an inverted V shape, basically what I wound up with, yes, I had a great inverted V, but it really just favored 20 meters. It becomes almost a perfect 20 meter antenna as an inverted V, but like 80, 10, 15, all the other ones are almost completely gone. It would load on them, but they just didn't seem to be the performance there, but there again, just my experience. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Here with a comment. Vic recognized, but let me go back to Glenn first. Glenn, you said it would load. In other words, it had reasonable standing wave ratio, but people were giving you poor signal reports. Is that what you were saying, Glenn? Go ahead, Glenn.
Exactly, Dick. And what I was using also as a reference to compare to was a fan dipole, because I had a fan dipole mounted very similarly. And, I'd put one up and then try it and see how that performed, in the same day. Because I could kind of like, I put a setup where I could kind of like hoist it with some pulleys in a couple of different places and pull one up and then try it and then bring it back down again, try the G5RV. And when I started getting the G5RV supported in the center, and the other thing too is that it seems to be height critical. I think the minimum height, you got to have like all the center and the two outside ends of it have to be up around 40 feet, and then it performs very, very well. I have to say, it's it can be compared with a lot of other antennas. It's a pretty good performer. But there again, I don't think it, when you are operating it below 40 feet or in an inverted V shape, you really get the performance that antenna is capable of. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, very fine, Glenn. There's another piece of hands-on experience by a man who's been there with good instrumentation and tried it. Thank you for your comments, Glenn. Victor, you want to tell us about your experience, WA2, Alpha Romeo, Quebec, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, ARQ. Yes, I've heard all of these comments multiple times. I've heard the thank you very much about the having the G5R view, the center and the two ends as a T-shaped. I've heard that many times mentioned that is one of the is very critical to the use up at 10 meters, not at 20 but at 10. That is exactly how I plan to my Wyndham is a flat top. And also the antennas that I will put up, whether I fix this one that I have up here now, and they're all going to be store bought. They're not going to be I'm not going to make them because they're going to have to come with the ballon that's good for the extra punch I want to put into the signal. The other thing I wanted to ask was I know that with respect to dipoles, actually. Everybody thinks that it works best on a half-wave antenna would work on the second harmonic as a quarter-wave dipole. Or is it the other way around? Excuse me. A half-wave dipole on the second harmonic would work just as well. But I've heard that the dipoles generally work well or better on the third harmonic center-fed. Not the off-center fed dipoles like the Wyndham is. How do you guys find that as far as the G5RV and the Wyndham? Is it better on the third harmonic, or does it favor that's the case. It favors the third harmonic, a dipole. Now, I don't know about an off-center fed, but the regular half-wave dipole would go with the third harmonic. WA2ARQ, back to the TechNet.
Yeah, there's lots of information about dipoles. Some of it is reasonably accurate, some of it's pretty far off. If you go to chapter number 4 of any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook after the first edition, first edition is chapter 3, second, third, and fourth edition, chapter 4. But you go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Every good library has one. Chapter number 4 has the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. What Brown and Woodward did is they did a man-year of work in roughly 1946, in which they took every possible diameter of monopole at every possible length and measured the real impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component. Let me drop. And a monopole antenna on an infinite ground plane is really exactly half of a dipole. A dipole is a pair of perfect monopoles back-to-back. So everything you read off the Brown and Woodward curves, one curve, which is 4-3, is the resistive component, and 4-4 is the reactive component, versus diameter and length. Every possible dipole you could build in free space is in those curves. You study those curves, and you'll see some very interesting information, if you know what you're looking at. As I said, the curves are for a monopole, so double all the lengths you read off the chart if you're using it for a dipole. What you'll discover is that you can make a dipole have its resistive component of impedance anywhere from 1,500 ohms down to 1 ohm inclusive. In other words, I could make you a dipole that's 1 ohm, 2 ohms, 10 ohms, 70 ohms, 200 ohms, 2,000 ohms. All I have to do is change the length, and I will get every one of those resistive values. The longer the dipole, the higher the impedance. Up to half wavelength per monopole, which is full wavelength for the full dipole. After that, things start repeating. So what happens when you take a half-wave dipole, where each side is a quarter wavelength long, at a reasonably thin wire, you will have something rather close to 70 ohms of center impedance. Make it shorter, the 70 ohms gets lower. Make it longer, the 70 ohms gets higher. That's the resistive component. Only at half wave for the full dipole, electronically half wave, is the reactive component zero. After that, shorter, you're going to have a strong capacitive reactance. Longer than half wave, you're going to have an inductive reactance. If you got the right kind of an antenna tuner, you can get rid of the inductive component. Let me drop. But the significant thing to know is that at half wave, center conductor, center impedance is close to 70 ohms. At full wave, which is half wave on each half, your center impedance is something like 1,500 to 2,000 ohms, an extremely high number. And unless you're feeding that with a perfect balance and extremely low insertion loss coax and a very large tuning range antenna tuner, to try to feed 1,500 or 2,000 ohms of an antenna is going to be tough. You go through the mathematics on that, you'll find out that your feed line is running at a 50-1 standing wave ratio, or is it 25-1, but it's a big number. The feed line's going to have a whole lot of extra loss. Your antenna tuner may run out of range, and for a whole bunch of reasons, you don't get much performance. When you go to the third, and that's what happens on second harmonic, you're going to half-wave dipole becomes a full-wave dipole on second harmonic. On third harmonic, you're now 1.5 wavelengths long, and the impedance starts coming back down to about 80 or 90 ohms, which is a lot easier to feed. The bottom line of all that is that unless you're using open-wire feed line, the nice thing about open-wire feed line, 600 ohm open line, is that if you fed it with a 30-1 standing wave ratio, it'll laugh at you and keep right on working. It's got very low insertion loss, and high VISWAR with a good antenna tuner is no problem on open wire line. You do that on coax, you feed coax with a 20-1 standing wave ratio, and you're going to get a lot of extra loss. So, and the balun itself, The Balun is made for a 1-to-1 impedance match, and you feed it with a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, the Balun will very easily saturate at the kilowatt level. So you think you've got a Balun when you're feeding the antenna on the second harmonic at any reasonable amount of power. You may not have a Balun left anymore, and you start getting lost there too. So these are some of the reasons you get some of those crazy characteristics. And I think now we're going to go over to discussing Baluns themselves. And a Balun can very easily saturate when you ask for those extremely high voltages that you get when you're feeding an antenna on the second harmonic. Let me drop. Now, let me give you a couple of words on what I think a Balun is doing, why in some cases it's so darn important. Every one of us, on a quick and dirty operation, when you're putting an antenna together in a hurry, it doesn't have to be perfect. You take the coax cable, you take the shield, and you connect it to one half of your dipole. You take the center conductor, and you connect it to the other half of the dipole. Works like a charm, and it's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. You're not going to get it's not doing anything illegal when you do that. However, there's a catch. And the catch is, you may think you're feeding the center of a dipole. You think you're feeding a piece of wire floating in free space with the egg insulators on the end, and you got it 40 feet in the air, and you think that the local ground doesn't matter, and the dipole itself is being fed left side versus the right side. You think that. Mother Nature has got a couple of tricks up her sleeve. The right-hand side of the dipole is approximately 35 ohms to ground. The left-hand side of the dipole is approximately 35 ohms to ground. You feed the center of those left-hand side and the right-hand side. You see the 235 ohms in series, you see 70 ohms. But there really is something close to 35 ohms to ground. And you say to yourself, hey Dick, how can there be 35 ohms to ground? The wire is hanging 40 feet in the air. Well, when it comes to RF frequencies, the word ground has got some very funny names, some very funny characteristics. An RF ground and a DC ground are very, very different. Even if you are doing an experiment where you're hanging 200 yards behind the space shuttle while the space shuttle is in orbit, and you say to yourself, I am really in free space. There ain't no ground for 160 nautical miles. You will think that there ain't any ground. You run a carefully controlled experiment, and again you will find that the right-hand side of the dipole will act like 35 ohms to ground, and the left-hand side will act like 35 ohms to ground, even though ground is 160 nautical miles away, because you're in orbit. Dipoles have that crazy characteristic. Once you accept that, and I may be exaggerating a little bit, but the concept is still there. Once you accept that, you'll suddenly realize that when you suddenly feed the center of your dipole, let me drop... You feed the center of your dipole with a piece of coax cable and no Balun, because the way the dipole itself tries to balance what's going on left side and right side, and your coax cable is trying to have all the RF on the center conductor, between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer shield is where the RF is flowing in the coax. Once it hits the dipole, and the dipole forces this kind of radio symmetry of the voltage being applied, you are, by the reaction of that dipole, launching a significant amount of current down the outside of the coax cable. And now, depending on the length of that coax cable and how well it's grounded in the shack, that length of cable will or will not be a resonant length. Some amount of RF energy flowing down that cable could give you a resonance effect in the shack. And in the worst case, guys run into a situation where they walk up to a D104 microphone, and if their lip touches the microphone, they get an arc between their lip and the metal of the D104 mic, because they got RF in the shack. Also, the RF flowing down the outside of the coax cable could drastically increase the amount of television interference in your apartment building or in your house, because maybe that coax cable lies close to some power wiring, and it's launching RF into the power wiring, and maybe it lies close to the transmission line that goes to the television set. So RF flowing down the outside of the cable is